We're glad to have everybody back with us. It was a small crowd last Lord's Day, but we have so many here today, it's just incredible. On both sides of the church, down through the aisles. This is just ministerially speaking, so people who think they're watching us, we have a large church. But when we have everybody gone, it's a small church, believe me. Nevertheless, I suspended our series last week in order to pick it back up so that you would not miss in the structure of what we are dealing with in the Ten Commandments. Now, I'm kind of hoping that once we get through this, and I figure we'll probably end somewhere around about 105 or 106 sermons, I'm thinking about going back and doing basic theology again, and I haven't decided exactly how I will do it, but I think it would be valuable to us because I have not just systematically taught through the basic doctrines of the Christian faith, especially as taught and instructed in the Reformed faith. But we are looking, sermon number 88, at the seventh commandment, which is, thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, this series is entitled, Written with the Finger of God. We've been talking about the law of God in covenantal context. We've defined the law. We've talked about its purpose, especially from the development of Puritan thinking as it develops in the United Kingdom on the heels of the Reformation, and thus written in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And we've been looking at this from the larger catechism. Now, I will not do what a minister did one Sunday. He was thinking about the idea of, had a fairly large church. He would just kind of shake everybody up a little bit. And he said, I have heard rumor that some of you may be running around with other men's wives. We're dealing with the question of adultery today in my sermon. And I want you to know that at the end of the service, if I don't have a $100 bill in the offering basket, I'm going to expose you who are cheating before this body. And at the end of the service, he had 19 $100 bills and one IOU. And but I know we don't have that problem in our church. I don't believe we do. So I won't pull that little number on you, to say the least. But seriously, it is a very important thing that we need to take a look at in dealing with this commandment. It is in the sequence of things. I told you, we build off the fifth and we move on to the rest of the commandments until we cover the tenth commandment. Our sermon text has been Deuteronomy 9, 10 through 11. Here we read, then the Lord delivered to me two tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass, at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, that the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Now, as I said, we are moving on to this, the seventh commandment. It is in the second table of the law. And the seventh commandment is dealing with adultery. Here, the divine right in question number 137 of the larger catechism, which is the seventh commandment? And they answered, the seventh commandment is, thou shalt not commit adultery. We find this commandment in Exodus 20 and verse 14. This is God's command as it applies to us in the structure of what these commandments are designed to do. Not just within a concept of community or nation, but remember, The very structure of this thing is about the family. And thus you can see how that this commandment, as well as the others, really aren't a national structure of laws to protect the nation as much as they are really designed to preserve the family itself. Which is why we simply have said over and over again, as the family goes, so goes the nation, and so goes its church. And thus it is very important to understand these laws are not just personal, but they're in particular familial in the sense that this is how you govern your family. And when the families are governed right, so will your community, so will your nation, so will your church. Well, then the divine is asking question 138. What are the duties required in the seventh commandment? Now I'm going to break this answer down because I want to document with you what the scripture says and why they put certain phrases here together and use certain words that I think were very important for them to be able to express the depth of this commandment. If you will, we're looking at the answer the divines have set forth. And they wrote, the duties required in the seventh commandment are chastity in body, mind, and affections. I want to deal with that first portion of this answer. We're told by Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4:4, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification. We have a duty being called especially into Christ, and yet there is a command that is generally cast among all men and women and every child within the context of the family, that we are to possess our vessels in sanctification of life. Not only sanctification, but he says, and honor. And honor. Now, what is required in this seventh commandment is built on the foundation of the fifth and the sixth commandment. If you remember, the fifth, as I said, was about family. And it really deals with the sanctity of the family within that context. How do we preserve the family? One, we understand the nature of the structure of authority that you find within a family. You have the father responsible to make the final decision for what is according to the word of God within the family. But he also shares that authority with his wife. She too is a parent. And as a result of that, they have a duty as superiors to teach and instruct the inferiors. One day when those children come up who are inferiors in that relationship of the family itself, and they get married, they create their own family. They separate out. They are no longer a part of the other family. They create a new family. But the duty here is based on the fifth commandment, this sanctity of the family. But then we look at the sixth commandment, and it has respect to the sanctity of life. Thou shalt not kill. Whereas, within that context, we now add another concept in respect to the sanctity of the family, which is what? It is in respect to the sanctity of sex or sexual reproduction, by which we do propagate in this life human lives, our posterity coming forward. The Apostle Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 7:34, there is a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. The seventh commandment in this way requires this whole concept of preservation, of being one family, united, husband and wife together, creating this institution. And in this institution, not only is the structure of understanding in its creation as a family, in that sphere where we have the family is central to both church and the state, there is the preservation of life that is required within that. And then there is this preservation of that sexual reproduction area of their life in which they are to commune one with another. Union is not to be with another, but between those who have vowed themselves to each other. Thus, the seventh commandment requires the preservation of our own and of our neighbor's chastity in all manners of words and actions. We are to keep the family, the marriage, pure before God and before the world. That's required us. Then they go on to just simply start listing these sanctities of life and how we ought to control them. For example, the next thing they say is words. Paul says in Colossians 4:6, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. We need to control our words in our life, especially as it pertains to the family and to the marriage of that family, the sanctity of husband and wife together, which is why, to a great extent, we would look upon the aspect of disdain with people who would say, well, you know, you're tying the knot. No, you're not tying the knot. That really is derogatory toward the aspect of what marital union is in a family. Oh, well, you've got the old ball and chain. No, you don't have the old ball and chain. All these things are worldly ways of talking about a very holy, an important thing that is established in order to not only have sanctity in your life and in your family, but as it also penetrates the community and nation of which you find yourself in. And thus, words and phrasings of words need to be careful, that we do not bring a derogatory meaning toward the very commandment God gave us of our family, of our union of husband and wife, and the sanctity that He has given before them together. Well, then they also go on and talk about behavior. In 1 Peter 3:2, we're told by Peter, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. There is to be a sanctity of your behavior, your conduct, of how you control yourself in this life. So it is, the Christian has a responsibility in the actions that he takes throughout his life, in his daily walk, before others. They can see there is love, there is union, there is here established something unique about them in that they have a family, they love life, they preserve each other's life, and they preserve their matrimony as being holy before God in all their words and in all their conduct. And then they go on to say, and the preservation of it in ourselves and others. We not only seek to preserve our conduct, but the conduct of others around us. 1 Corinthians 7:2, here Paul writes, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." Because of the sexual immorality that goes on around by people who know not Christ, do not let a man go on and live out his life, especially in this whole concept of this immorality that you have among the people of the world. We do not act like the world. We are different. We are a holy people. We are set aside to live a holy, righteous life. And thus the best way for a man and for a woman to preserve themselves before God in this commandment is that each have their own partner in life and committed to that partnership. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, and then in verse 35 through 36, "And this I say for your own profit." That is to say, for your benefit. "Not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction." This is your calling. You are called as a child of God to serve the Lord. Paul says, I don't want to have to put a leash on you, although I think some Christians could do well with a leash. But nevertheless, this he's saying for their benefit. Verse 36. "But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she is past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry." In order to preserve the sanctity of their relationship, they should marry. Paul says it's better to marry than it is to burn. It is an ordinance by God that man was created and then woman was created for the man. She serves with him. She serves beside him. She understands that he has responsibility for those final decisions that have to be made. And yet, he understands his relationship to her as to understanding how to preserve their life together. And I think that's important. Because some, and I don't think it's here, but there are some people in the world who think that a wife is simply a doormat for the husband. That's just not the case. No man who's respectable, who has to make and will make all those decisions, will do it without the consent of his wife, without seeking her agreement. I have never tried to make decisions apart from my wife. I'm an idealist. I literally walk 6 feet above the ground. My wife is a realist, and she keeps pulling me back down saying, that won't work. And that's frustrating sometimes. But I don't make decisions apart from her. She is a part of my life. And so it's important. Apostle Paul here is saying, know how you handle your virgin, that chaste woman whom you are, I would assume, probably engaged to at this point. But if necessary, go ahead and marry. Better to marry than to fall in the concept of sexual immorality, the perversions of sex that go on in society, than it is for you to marry. And so, go ahead, he does nothing wrong when he marries. Marriage is sacred. Marriage is honorable before God. One of the things I teach when I do marriage counseling, especially couples that are having real problems, and I say, well, tonight before you decide to come together, before you go to bed, please get on your knees and thank God for your marriage and for the relationship you have to each other. And they just look at you with absolute horror on their face. You want us to pray before we have a sexual relationship? I said, well, yeah. Why not thank God for the fact he gave you to each other? And that you are appreciative and you will do as he has commanded you to do. I said, do you think that God doesn't and is not there when you have that relationship? He's there. Before him, it is pure. It is right. It is not a dirty thing the way that our society and every society since the garden has tried to make the sexual relationship of the union that should be between husband and wife. So I encourage you to consider that very thing. Why? Because it represents something. Why? It represents the union of Christ and his church coming together. And it is a beautiful union indeed. Then he said we need to be watchful over our eyes and all of our senses. Job 31:1 says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? I made a covenant with my eyes. I shall not look upon that which would distract me, which would draw me away from the sanctity of my relationship with my wife. And then they say there is temperance. Temperance being a moderation. In Acts 24:24-25, we read, and after some days, when Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now, as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, which is what temperance is, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. There is to be this aspect of self-control in the life that is lived righteously before our God. And so the divine said, we need to have a life that is self-controlled. A life that is not just led around by its own desires, but a life that is led around by the law of God that curbs our desires. We have self-control. There's where the law of God really becomes important to us. It's about self-control. The Constitution of the United States cannot make people live right. It's self-control. You must live your own life personally in relationship to the commandment of God. And then you must apply that within your marital relationship. And then the family structure. That in turn will go out both to church and to state. Do you see this? It is a brilliant understanding of the law of God. Of how it was to be applied. Self-control. And the divines understood that. And then they went on to say, you're to be keeping chaste company. What does it say? You're to be living with people who live that same moral, self-controlled life. Proverbs 2, 16 through 20 says, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house leads down to death and her path to the dead. None who go to her return, nor do they regain the path of life, so you may walk in the way of goodness and keep the path of righteousness. Avoid the seductress. Avoid those who do not keep chaste company. They cannot lead you but to sin, whether it is in your thought or whether it is in your deed. And here in Proverbs, he's talking about in particular that woman who is the seductress. Her path does not lead to happiness. It does not lead to satisfaction. It leads to death, to the destruction of her life and the destruction of your life, and a path you will never recover from. You'll live with it the rest of your life. Your companion will live with it the rest of their life. You never are able to so sanctify your family again as you once had in its purity. That's the importance. That's the importance to marry rather than burn. To stay out of the way of those who are unchaste and stay with those who believe in applying the law of God. Whether you're married or not, these principles all govern who we are individually and as husband and wife in that family corporate relationship of the fifth commandment. Well, then they go on and they begin to talk in a way that is just, I think personally is getting down to where they're really nailing it on the head. These become very personable things. Understand, this is where you want to set somebody off, this is where you start setting them off. All of a sudden they go, well, you're just being legalistic. Not true. Then they go on to say that you're to be modest in your apparel. And the way you dress. Modest. Not in a way that tempts someone else. That seeks to draw the attention away from what they're doing to you. Doesn't matter whether it's male or female. Timothy, in 1 Timothy 2:9, Paul says, in like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, dress modestly, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing. Do not draw attention to yourself. Do not attract others. Now that wouldn't probably go over well in our society today. As a matter of fact, I don't think it goes over very well in our evangelical churches today. Modest dress is important. You're not to draw the affections of those around you. What you're to do is to dress modestly so that they are not drawn to you in their life, whether it's thought or deed, lest it would lead them astray. Well, the divines then go on to say, marriage by those that have not the gift of continency or self-restraint. 1 Corinthians 7:2. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, we read this, let each man have his own wife, and each woman have her own husband. Then Paul says in 7:9, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And then Paul said, or then the divine said, they almost should consider conjugal love. And Proverbs 5:19-20. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Let our love, an expression of our love, which is really the affection of that relationship that we have as not just husband and wife, but as marriage partners. Friendship. Marriage is built off of godly friendship. And the expression of that friendship in marriage is that intimacy of love between one another. Enjoy the life God has given you. Sexual relationship within the boundaries of God's law is a beautiful thing. It's always depicted as a thing of beauty. One to be enjoyed. Unlike, we know, the Roman Catholic Church says, well, the only purpose of sex is to have children. No, it's not. The purpose of a sexual relationship is to express love between husband and wife. Children are a benefit that comes from that expression. And then they said cohabitation. Peter writes in 1 Peter 3:7, husbands likewise dwell with them with understanding, that is the wife, giving honor to the wife. Honor her. Respect her for who God created her to be. Give honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together by the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. May not be hindered in this life. And so it is, there is this duty and responsibility that we have. That when we cohabit together, when we are married and we are living together, husbands, you have a duty and a responsibility as the head of the family, but you also have a duty and responsibility to love your wife, to treat her the way that Christ would treat His church, with love, honor, and understanding. In order that your prayers may not be hindered in this life. But you may live to the fullness of God's grace together. In union. Not disunion. And then they said they need to be diligent labor in our callings. That is to say, we need to be diligent in what we are called to serve. What we are called to do. You can't be diligent in that when you're chasing around immoral perversions. Proverbs 31:11 says, the heart of her husband safely trust her, so he will have no lack of gain. He trusts his wife. The union of their relationship strong. Because they listen, they hear, they perform, they do what is necessary according to the law of God to live the life that they are to live. Proverbs 31:27-28 says, she watches over all the ways of her household. Who? The wife. And does not eat the bread of idleness. She has a job. job is in the home. It's in caring for her husband. It's in caring for her children. It is in caring for their property. She is basically the home manager for him. Her children rise up, call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Then they say that we are to be shunning all occasions of uncleanness in our life and resisting temptations thereunto. Proverbs 5:8 says, remove your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house. It's talking about the seductress. Move away from temptation. Don't be associated with it. Don't walk in that path. If you know there is a pathway, you need to avoid that path. You need to avoid that which will tempt you into destroying the bond of your union that you have together as husband and wife. And Genesis 39:8-10, but he refused, and he said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. You remember this? This is Jacob. Joseph. There is no one greater than this in this house than I, nor hath he kept back anything from me but you. I have been made second in the land of Egypt. I've been given everything to control. I am forbidden from nothing but you, his wife, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness? That is, she wanted him to come and to commit adultery with him. And he says, and sin though, not against his master, against his God. So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Well, there you have the ideal of what the divines say. We are involved in and understanding that duty of the seventh commandment. Well, what is the cause of the violation of the seventh commandment? That's got to be our base question. It is this. The real basic cause of the violation of this commandment is basically a spiritual problem. Specifically, it comes from a corrupt, sinful condition of the human heart. That's where it comes from. It is your own corruption that has led you down this path of destruction. Matthew 5:19 says, for out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, theft, false witness, blasphemies. The violation of this commandment comes from within you. Oh, the temptation may be there, but whether or not you partake of the temptation, it's coming from here, inside. Now, there are many influences in the modern life that has contributed greatly to violations of this commandment. And I want to deal with some aspects of those things, but not all of them. The violation of the seventh commandment has been greatly increased, especially by the popular acceptance of various types of modern psychologies which stress self-expression. The best way in life, in order to really live life, is to give expression to your life in your desires. We see that both in pragmatism, William James, you know, the old saying, it's the popular version of it is, if it feels good, do it. and in the instrumentalism of John Dewey, which is a part of our public educational philosophy. Let each child actualize in the things that they desire, and do not interfere with them. That has had a major impact of late in our nation. And I say of late, I'm talking the latter part of the 1800s and early 1900s through to today. This type of psychology, or really it's based on a philosophical view of the world, favors the unrestrained indulgence of natural impulses, regardless of the prohibitions of the law of God and the ordinance of marriage. It encourages unrestrained indulgence. No doubt many people have carried the implications of this type of philosophy much further than many of the original scholars probably, maybe even intended in its formulation. But there is no doubt that this philosophical or psychological self-expression has been used by many people as a convenient exercise for the indulgence in impure lust of the flesh. You want to know why we are corrupt and having the problems in our society that we've had? We have subjected our people, our families, our children to these corrupt philosophies, to these corrupt psychologies. And they are simply now coming to fruition after many years of teaching. We put our kids into public school. They get 30 to 40 hours a week of humanist education. And somehow you think 2 hours on Sunday is going to make a difference. It just isn't going to do it, folks. They come home, they turn on the TV. Everything almost today is sold by sex. All sexual implications. Impurity. Perversion. It's there. The shows promote it. Homosexuality and every other kind of perversion you can imagine. It's all being promoted. And the kids and even ourselves as adults are being influenced by it. We're being desensitized to the offensiveness of it. The result has been this general decrease of opposition to sins. The sins of fornication, the sins of adultery, unscriptural divorce, remarriage, and other issues that we find not just in our nation, in its society, but even in our churches and our homes. These sins are nothing new. They've existed since the very early times of creation. In Genesis 38, I don't have time, I'm running out of time, but if you'll take time and read it, you can read how that these sexual impure concepts have taken place early on in the world of which we live. Perversions have existed. And here you have, both in Genesis 34 and this text here, you have the perversion of Judah himself and his relationship with his daughter-in-law. If you really want to see how we have been affected, please take a read. For we have been affected for a long time. Sometimes you have more sexual activity and perversions going on, and sometimes, of course, you may have less. But the truth is, the common types are there, And sometimes even the more ill common ones are also there. Those that normally you would not see. And I say to you that this is a revolt from the moral law of God. Society has embraced it. They hate God. They're not Christian. The church itself almost seems to be a hater of God and the life that they lived before Him. Which is a sad story of our church today. In our society. The evangelical church has very little influence today. The reality is we face today a situation in which many well-educated and respected people regard the expression of the sex instinct not as a moral question subject to the law of God, but merely as a matter of one's personal preference. That's how it's being cast off. It's just a matter of personal preference. That's all. It's not a question of is it objective. And is it objected to by God and His law? We just simply pass it off as one's moral choice today. Thus, there are many today who hold that sexual relations apart from marriage is legitimate. That marriage is not necessarily permanent, nor is it necessary any longer. It is a practice of historical content that no longer needs to be continued. It's simply a paper contract that is signed, nothing more. There has not in the past been such a justifying of sexual immorality on the part of prominent people in a country enjoying the light of the Christian religion as exists in this nation today. We have had the truth in America for so long, and yet what has happened to that witness and truth? Measure your society, measure its sins. A Samaritan woman who had five husbands was living with a sixth to whom she was not lawfully fully married. We know that in John 4, in verse 17 and 18. Was no doubt regarded as immoral in her day, even in her society that was not Christian per se. But in America today, there are plenty of people who approach if they do not see that record, and yet they are regarded as worthy and respectable citizens on unscriptural grounds because they hold to the idea that it's not a person's character that it's questioned here. It's simply a matter of they've created a problem in their life. It's not sin. Or if you will, it's just a piece of bad luck that has happened upon them. That's how we've come. We've come from times where nations without the light of the gospel did not and had monogamous relationships. Some did not, but most did. Marriage meant something back then. And you were considered immoral or impure if you did not live to the purity of the relationship. But no more. I can remember a time as I was growing up when my mother would get together with her friend who lived down the street. And if they would start talking about someone in the church who was having some kind of a perverted relationship with someone else outside of their marriage, and they would talk very quietly, very hush-hush about it. It was like a thing that you really almost shouldn't mention, which they probably shouldn't have. But today, people don't feel that way. We just shake our heads and go, well, you know, that ain't going to work out. I came from a church that literally, I know, was almost a pagan place. It had the worst reputation in town. Everybody was running around trying to be with other women who were not their wives. How can that exist in the Church of Jesus Christ that claims to be a pure church? Well, I don't think it's gotten much better. I think it's gotten even worse. Because the pure gospel has not been properly preached. Thus, all these perversions are simply social stigmas in our society. They're not seen as ungodly, sinful practices, whether it's fornication, adultery, whether it's unlawful marriage relationships that are out there being created, whether it's divorce, whether it's remarriage, no one really cares anymore. This simply shows how far public opinion has moved away from the moral standard of God's law. The question is, in this commandment, are we going to seek to keep the purity and the union of our marriages pure before God? He showed us family. He showed us the sanctity of life itself. Now he's showing us the sanctity of that relationship that comes in a marital union, husband with wife. And they very natural process that God has ordained for the future of our families and of our nation, of our church. The church and the nation do not reproduce. Only families do. What are you going to do with it? That's really the question. What do you do with it in your life? There are so many temptations. We've never had it served up this way before. Not hard to have the temptation to walk through your door. It used to be you had to go outside of the home to fall in those temptations. Now they follow you home. Matter of fact, they beat you to the front door. And you walk in and you're facing them at so many levels. The question is, the divines have read, if you will, again, their answer to this. What are the duties required in this for you? How are you to live your life in order to be one who lives according to this law and is pure? I think that's a big question. One that we must live with and one that we must ensure others live with it as well. Consider these things, for I think they're so important to the preservation of our families, to the preservation of our church, and to the preservation of the society within our nation. No nation and no family and no individual will escape the judgment of God in these matters. Shall we pray?